Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, everybody, back to the New Books and Buddhist Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sansreya Mayujid, and I'm the host of the channel for today. So, delighted to welcome Professor Bertha Jansson, who is the chair of Central Asian Studies at the Institute of Indian and Central Asian Studies at the University of Leipzig, and the author of The Monastery Rules, Buddhist Monastic Organization in Pre-Modern Tibet, that we're going to be talking about today, which was published by the University of California Press. Welcome, Bertha.
So nice to be here.
it's so lovely to have you here. I remember attending your talk at the International Association for Tibetan Studies seminar in 2013 in Mongolia. I think I was just a master's student, and I was so inspired and also terrified at the prospect that you were one of the few people working on the topic at the time. And then to witness the field just explode over the years with you in the center, it's been quite a journey. So could you tell us a bit about you and your journey so far?
That's first of all, just responding to that, that's absolutely right. And it's so nice. We've just had another one of these conferences, and I have found that people have really taken up the study of these monastic guidelines. And people are other scholars other than me are engaging with the material, and this is just really wonderful to see. I'm so happy to see these wonderful source materials being really taken up and used by others. But first, I'll just say something about myself, and I came to Buddhist studies and Tibetan studies in this sort of roundabout way, I would say. I was interested in Tibet actually really from a rather young age. I think I was about 9 or 10 when I really started sort of learning about Tibet. And first of all, from a sort of more activist or sort of political motivation. My mother was a Tibet supporter, so we would get these sort of newsletters, and it was also the heyday of peak Tibet in sort of Hollywood and all the sort of more popular media. So I got very interested, involved in Tibetan sort of more political issues, and from that actually I started to get interested in. Intrigued by the Dalai Lama, and I was thinking if he has, and he had just won the Nobel Prize, and I thought if he has all these things to say, or he does these wonderful things for Tibetans, then he might also have some other interesting things to say. So I started reading. I was quite a precocious child. I started reading books on Buddhism when I was about 11, 12, and I can't claim that I really understood anything, but there was some kind of pull towards that. So initially it was more, I was interested in Tibet and became more and more interested in Buddhism from a more sort of a practitioner angle. There wasn't really so much sort of academic interest there initially. And when I was 18, I went to India to study Buddhism. And I lived in Dharamsala for 6 months the first time around. And then I decided I wanted to study Tibetan, but not in an academic way again, but to become an interpreter. So after that, I went back and in the end stayed for 5 years to study Tibetan and Buddhism in McLeod Ganj in Dharamsala, where I also did the Lhotsaw Rinchen Sangpo Translator Program, which is a program of the FPMT. And I managed to finish that and become an interpreter for Buddhist Tibetan, and I worked as an interpreter for a number of years. It's something that I still occasionally do. And moving back to the West, the way I got into studying, and I'd never been to university or college previously, was actually because we in the Netherlands we had a rather generous sort of scholarship system. And, you know, as an interpreter, I wasn't making enough money to live off. And then I thought, well, you know, I could also just as a, you know, being a part-time interpreter, I could just sort of enroll in university and see what happens. And it was a way to sort of get by. It turned out it was, and I studied Indology with sort of a large dose of Tibetan and Tibet in there as well, and Buddhism, at Leiden University. And I won a scholarship to go to Oxford and do my master's there in Tibetan Himalayan studies, my MPhil. And after that, I was offered a PhD position with Professor Jonathan Silk, again back in Leiden. And this is also sort of how the topic of the book came to be, because I was employed as a PhD student within the context of a research project that Professor Silk held, and that was the general topic was Buddhism and social justice. And this meant we had a sort of a research group, which was wonderful, with someone in India doing Indian Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, and later on also Chinese Buddhism. So we were quite a mixed bunch, and we were engaging with the sort of idea of what is the social position of Buddhism and Buddhists in Asia, both in the past and in the present, but mostly most of us are sort of more working on the historical side of things. So engaging with this sort of very difficult, very Western idea of social justice got me thinking about, you know, what did all these monks in Tibet, what was their social position? What did they do? What did they contribute to society? And to what extent was that sort of driven by Buddhist ideology or, you know, Buddhist ideas? And that got me interested or got me working on the topic, which eventually became this book.
That's great. I love how, you know, you just thought, hey, what's going to happen? And here you are. It's quite wonderful. Yeah. And so I'm sure all the people out there embarking on a project that deals with very much understudied genres of Buddhist texts, myself included, would love to hear more about the process of you kind of choosing these texts, finding them, and how these kind of grew. If you could share your experience, maybe some of the challenges, and if there's any memorable moments that come to mind.
Yes, I think, I mean, maybe this is gives some hope to people who sort of struggle with their choice of topic, and because this was initially my plan B, what I had, what I wanted to do was, choose a particular monastery in Tibet and, you know, study that from all angles. So use textual sources, oral history, and just look and manuscripts and documents, whatever I could find, and then look at it from all angles. So the lay people perspective, monastic perspective, you know, governmental perspective, what have you. And to do that, I started preparing and just reading everything that was about Tibetan monasticism and monasteries and monks, and also Tibetan materials. And this is how I sort of chanced upon this genre of monastic guidelines of Jaik. And I started reading them, and I thought, these are quite interesting. And, you know, I sort of made a note of them and put them aside. And then I went on a sort of a pre-fieldwork trip back in 2011. And because, you know, doing fieldwork in central Tibet is really, well, let's say, near impossible, I went to Kham, to eastern Tibet, and I got set up really, you know, it was really quite nice. I had very good contacts with a monastery. I was got permission from the head lamas to be there. I had all these sort of names of people who could help me, etc. And then when I got there, or sort of on the road there, I was turned back. And, you know, it was a rather sensitive time in Kham, particularly in eastern Tibet. And in the end, I was turned back, and there was sort of a pretext of, you know, the road being snowed over, and there was, you know, it wasn't safe to go. And, you know, of course, later in the day, the driver sort of came to find me and say, you know, oh, no, the road is fine, we can go. And I said, well, maybe they don't want me to be there. So that trip ended in, you know, disaster. It was sort of the worst possible scenario you could imagine doing pre-field work, because the question I went with was, would it be possible to do this kind of field work? And I came back with a very clear answer, no, unfortunately. And this is when I decided to focus on that genre of text that I had encountered previously, that I found absolutely fascinating. And I decided that it would be not a study of one particular monastery, but a study of all monasteries in Tibet, which is, of course, in some ways easier, and in many ways also a lot more difficult.
Gosh.
Yes, that was terrible. But I think in the end, you know, it was all for the best, because hopefully this research has a sort of a broader appeal to scholars and other readers, because it's not so much a micro study, but a macro study of Tibetan monasticism.
No, definitely. Yeah, I was looking through your bibliography and just being completely taken back by the number of Chaigs that you looked at. So could you tell us a bit more about these texts, Chaigs, what they are, and what are they exactly, and what can we see in them?
So these Chaig, these are, when they are written for monasteries, they're monastic guidelines, which are basically works that deal with the organization of monasteries and monks. They are to sort of order monks. They are sort of local rules, the rules that you might have for, let's say, a university or other sort of communities. And very interesting about this genre of works is that they interact with, you know, the monastic Indic codes, so the Vinaya, but at the same time, they also react to situations on the ground. So they also sort of set themselves up to being, in many ways, it's very local and temporary documents. So saying, you know, they react and they would sort of literally say, for this particular time and place, we need some specific rules. And what we then get is sources that are very valuable for, let's say, the social history of monasteries, because they describe not the ideal and sort of the idealized information that we often get from autobiographies and other sort of Tibetan religious sources, but we get documents, we get sources that both interact with Buddhist ideas, at the same time they interact with what was happening right there and then. So in that sense they're pretty unique as this kind of genre goes, I would say.
And is there something that you can use to call them a genre? Because I guess in some ways it sounds almost as if some of them can be quite different to one another, depending on the period of history or the location.
Yes, I mean, there are many this is quite a long discussion one could have on to what extent it's one genre. We can see it sort of developing as a genre more later on, so from the 14th, 15th century onwards, and it's really established as a genre from the 17th and 18th century onwards. But we have earlier, you could say, proto-jaic monastic guidelines that sometimes address not just monks, but also other practitioners, not necessarily ordained people. So they address a religious community. One also finds the same words, Tibetan words, used to address lay communities. So the word has a broader usage to some extent, but I would say the lion's share of the jaic that we have deal particularly with monasteries and of course also nunneries. So I would say that yes, in that sense, when you sort of define it more narrowly, then you can definitely talk about a genre there, and then you have of course a few outliers that fit, but you sort of understand why they are called jaic as well. So you know that the whole translation of the word, so it's a short form for jaic, is a short form for the Tibetan chimsu jaoyi, which is document that establishes the rules or the law. And this is, of course, you know, this could be more broadly applicable as well. But if you would, for example, go out nowadays to and ask monks, and this is what I did as part of my fieldwork, this time not in Tibetan areas in the PRC, but in India, in exile, when you go out and ask monks, you know, what is a jaic and what does it do? And, you know, people would be adamant in saying, you know, every monastery has to have one. It's absolutely vital that a monastery has one. So it's very much seen as part and parcel of the sort of, you know, it's a tool for a monastic organization.
I see. And that brings us to the monasteries. I think you mentioned in your book that between the 10th and 20th century, there was at least 6,000 monasteries being established in just the political area of Tibet. That's a huge number of monasteries. So as the expert, could you tell us a bit more about the organization of monasteries and, you know, what are monasteries in Tibetan context and how do they differ from other Buddhist monasteries in other regions?
So yes, I mean the number of 6,000 is one that I didn't come up with myself, but it's sort of well established that sort of there were bigger and small and many smaller monasteries in you know the greater political Tibet, and you know if one believes the claim of Tibetan monks nowadays that all monasteries had to have at least one jayik, then, and also the fact that jayik were regularly updated. So, you know, often the texts themselves also state, well, you know, there is already a set of monastic guidelines for this monastery, but things have happened in the meantime and we had to update the rules. So it, also if one takes into account the fact that many monasteries had multiple of these works, and then you start sort of making a calculation, 6,000 monasteries, you know, multiplied by, you know, maybe two jayik, which would be quite a conservative estimate, then we come up with a huge number of jayik. And I have located maybe more than 200. And actually, since the publication of the book, I have found a couple more. So that just goes to show how many have not turned up, and also how many are probably actually actually lost. But getting back to your question about you know, what they actually did, or how these monasteries actually then functioned in Tibet, this is of course this is the perhaps the largest part of my book is about that, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to look at the way that the monastery functioned in society, in Tibetan society, and actually not Tibetan society, Tibetan Buddhist societies. So I also look at works written for Mongolian monasteries, Himalayan monasteries, so in Nepal, in Spiti, in Ladakh, and Bhutan. And I wanted to understand them and understand their relationship with lay people, relationship with the government, and sort of these and the extent to which these relationships had and whether they had anything to do with Buddhist beliefs. But actually, in order to do that, what I realized was that there wasn't when I was starting this research, I realized there wasn't a lot of scholarship on how these monasteries actually sort of functioned in a sort of a more practical way. So, you know, how would they get around, how they were organized economically, how who could enter the monastery, who was in charge of all these, all the management of the monastery, how did it, you know, all these sort of daily you know, rules and regulations were not at all known or hardly known or written on when I started this research. So this is something that I really had to tackle. I mean, and that's also how the book became a combination of you know, providing very practical information about, you know, who did what in the monastery, and how much tea was served to whom and why, but then also more of the Buddhist reasoning behind the actual management and the management of the economic the economic issues, and also managing sort of more legal matters as well. So yeah, that's how that's so this book, it has, in that sense, it's sort of a mixed the result is that you know, some things are matter, some parts are rather practical, and other parts are very much more sort of engage with issues that are of broader interest to people in Buddhist studies. And this is also what I've tried to do throughout my work, is to also you know, look at other kinds of Buddhist monasticisms, other kinds of how monasteries in, for example, in Sri Lanka, in Burma, in Thailand, in China, and to a lesser extent Japan, were organized, and how they would sort of be managing the monasteries, how they would be dealing with lay people, and how they would be also sort of linking that to rules found in the Vinaya. And I think that makes it, hopefully, I hope that makes it less something that is of course maybe useful to people in Tibetan studies, but also interesting to people in Buddhist studies more generally.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, you're definitely quite right though. I just remember a bit from, I think, I can't remember which chapter now, where you were talking about Stephen Collins's Selfless Persons and how he attempted to look at social difference in thought and practice taken into account by Buddhist doctrine and how they affected. And you proposed to, I think, inverse it and look at how this reflects in the context of the functions of monasteries in society. And I thought that was fascinating, especially taking into account the economics and the relationship between the laity and the monastery, worldly and spiritual. I wonder if you could say something a bit more about the social aspect.
Yeah, so what Collins, of course, did in this is in a very wonderful way is also linking, things that are interesting, when you're dealing with societies or sociology, perhaps even. So it's looking at how social differences in thought and practice would be taken account of by Buddhist doctrine. But then what I have tried to do is to actually inverse it and saying, what I wanted to do is look at the ways in which social differences and relationships then, existed within a Buddhist society. But also to examine then how or whether these differences were in any way justified by aspects of Buddhist thinking. So taking the realities on the ground again first, and then trying to come up with or see if any kind of Buddhist ideology becomes apparent in this investigation. So. Well, the studies that we have that deal with Buddhist monasteries, when they are not totally sort of starry-eyed, and when they don't, talk about monks as being these wonderful holy creatures, praying for the welfare of all living beings, and that being the only thing that they do, scholars, especially in the past, and of course Melvin Goldstein would be one of the primary scholars there. When they write about monasteries, then we get this very you know, dry account of you know, monasteries only acting out of self-interest. And of course, we also do get this accusation of feudalism, and, you know, monasteries have been accused of basically being responsible for, you know, the Tibet's loss of independence even. And then these studies don't take into account Buddhist thinking. And this is also often because these people have not learned about Buddhism. So, of course, if you don't know it, you don't see it. And once you learn it, then you start seeing it everywhere. And this is what I found, is that, you know, for me not, but maybe for some people, in some surprising ways, these monastic guidelines and therefore also the monasteries, in fact, eventually truly engage with rules in the Vinaya, and even when it doesn't serve their interest, they would still engage with the Vinaya. You see that the way that monasteries functioned, acted, managed themselves was essentially to perpetuate themselves. And of course, these are institutions, and you know, the institution is bigger than the individual. So, you know, that would already be a reason to perpetuate a certain kind of institution. But what I truly believe is that at least the authors of these guidelines were concerned not just with their monastery prospering, but also they saw the monastery as a vehicle for the flourishing of the Dharma. And, you know, and of course the rationale, which is very well known, is if the Dharma flourishes, then, you know, people will be able to practice and people will be able to accumulate, you know, good karma, and, you know, they will be able to do virtuous things, which would result in happiness for people. And also, you know, obviously local people, to have a prospering monastery nearby would mean that, you know, your area, would prosper, you know, your harvest would be good, you know, that the local gods would be happy and all that. So I do feel that these monasteries and the authors of these monastic guidelines truly felt a responsibility for their surroundings, but just not in the way that we would think of, and of you know, a monastery's responsibility. And this is, of course, also because we, and of course, even the word monastery is very loaded with Christian connotations, and we have this idea of monks and nuns, and this is, you know, very strongly influenced by you know, the Christianity you know, being predominant in the Western world, that monks and nuns are there to be of service directly to people. And, you know, it's of course very interesting that Christian monasteries, and I've also sort of tried to engage with writing on Christian monasticism, Christian monasteries, and this scholarship is much, you know, further developed, where the argument is actually made that monasteries were, early medieval monasteries were in fact responsible for, or sort of the very initial or, you know, starting institutions that we still have today, which have been vital to, you know, sort of welfare of humans. So, for example, you can think of hospitals and old people's homes and orphanages and all these kind of sort of more sort of well-established educational institutions. These were all initially set up by Christian monks and nuns. So we have this idea of this is how this should be the function of monasteries. And then we go to not just Tibet, I would say, we go to Asia and we see that the situation is really quite different. And now I'm talking more of the the pre-modern situation. Of course, the modern situation is quite different. And these days we find that monks and nuns do a tremendous amount of good works. Buddhist monks and nuns do tremendous work for people and also for animals. But in the past, it was different. And, you know, one of the questions I ask in the book is, you know, these Christian monasteries developed in this way. And in fact, if you look at it, Tibetan monasteries had the means. They had educated people. They had the wealth. They had the power, you could say. Why did they not establish these kinds of things? And of course, this is not the most important question, but it's still something that I engage with. And I think, yeah, one of the answers is why they did not see themselves as having such a social function, sort of a direct or sort of being responsible directly for the welfare of other people, is exactly that much more far-reaching aim that monastics had and have, that is, you know, being of benefit to all sentient beings. So then there, you know, the continuity of the monastery is much more important than helping, the poor people in the village, for example.
Mm. And who were the authors of these texts? Do we know that?
For most of the extant monastic guidelines, we know, because this is how they were preserved in the collected works of these authors, so the Sungbum. And this is how we can find most of the where we can find most of the Jaik. Sometimes they were also anonymous, and then there are a lot less of those. And you know, the colophon would then state that it was a group of monks who were, you know, who would have managerial positions in the monastery, who had come together and talked about issues and wrote down a certain document. And I think this is, in fact, how most monastic guidelines would have come about anyway. But of course, you need some, especially, you know, in the Tibetan context, you need some figure of authority approving it. You know, otherwise the monks would simply not accept, accept these rules. They would have to be made acceptable by having an important master or lama, you know, signing his name to the document. So often we see that the authors also state that they have consulted, monks in the management, and that they, you know, in accordance with their with sort of speaking with them, deliberating with them, they had written down these rules. And this has to be the case because we have all these sets of monastic guidelines that were written by, for example, the fifth Dalai Lama for areas where the fifth Dalai Lama had never been, for monasteries in areas where he'd never been. So it was very clear that it sort of the contents of these chaik would be based on whatever the managers would have communicated to him, and he would just write it down and give his views on it. and then, you know, put his name down, and then it would be, you know, would have some kind of authority. But of course, you know, all the monastic guidelines obviously were written by monks. Even the ones that we have for nunneries, we have very few of those, unfortunately. And this is something that I hope, you know, these are the documents that I hope will still turn up. So I think I have found about four that were written for nunneries. You know, all of them were written by male monastic authors. When I asked, when I did my fieldwork, and I asked one of the abbots for, you know, contemporary nunnery in India, I asked, you know, why do we have that? Why do we have all these monastic guidelines for monasteries and so few for nunneries? And he would just, you know, and of course, this is something that I find difficult to believe, but he would say, yeah, well, nuns are much more more disciplined, so they don't need that many rules.
We knew that wasn't true in the Vinaya.
Exactly. I was going to say this, exactly the opposite of what we find in the Vinaya. So this is something that maybe if anyone is listening to this, you know, I can go out and look for these jaik for nunneries, because they're going to be really quite interesting to study.
No, definitely. Yeah, so it probably also tells us something about the relationship between different monasteries and the hierarchies between like main monasteries and sister monasteries and nunneries also?
Yes and no, actually. I mean, what I have found is that, you know, by studying these monastic guidelines as a genre, then you can see very big differences in the target audience. So clearly, when we have a main monastery, then, you know, there's a lot more that the authors are often more concerned with the way that the monastery looks politically. When they're rich, of course, they're less concerned with, so that's also a factor, you know, the economic status of the monastery. You find, you know, the economic status really is reflected also in these monastic guidelines. It unfortunately does not give a very good picture of how main monasteries related themselves to subsidiary monasteries. What we do see is that, you know, subsidiary monastic guidelines for these smaller branch monasteries, they would say, okay, so we are a branch monastery of this and that monastery, but our situation on the ground is different, so therefore we need different rules. And then they would say, okay, you know, the liturgy, the prayers, and that sort of the calendar. And this is another topic that the jaik contains a lot of information about, you know, what puja to do when. So this is also before I started working on this. You know, the scholars who did know a little bit about these texts would often say, oh yes, well, those are the boring ones with just, you know, calendar dates and names of prayers in them. And in fact, you know, some of them are full of that, but I've actually found that the largest part actually is much more engaging than just talking about when to do which prayer. So, you know, they would be the same, these monastic guidelines, in terms of, you know, the liturgical calendar, but then they would differ, and sometimes also they would explicitly do so and say, you know, our situation is different from the main monastery, and we cannot afford to do this and this, or we have to act so and so. So it does give you an idea of the relations in that sense. But I would say that, you know, this is really a topic that really needs, is in dire need to be properly researched. This relationship between main monasteries and branch monasteries, also in terms of sort of the economic situation and micro political situations. This is something that I think the take that I had did not give a great deal of information on, but it's something that somehow we need to work on in more detail.
Definitely. I have so much to ask you, but I'm going to hold back right now. and then just kind of remembering back to parts of the book, like the legal function of these monasteries, where I think these chaigs even mention things like punishments and relating not just to monastics, but also the laity.
Yes, I think this is one of the, for me, surprising outcomes of the research, was that, you know, we have this idea of monasteries sort of taking care of themselves, and, you know, but at the same time, they're also in society. But what we see is, and that is what I found rather surprising, is that in quite a few instances, monasteries were allowed or expected even to punish lay people as well. So to be in charge of legal matters when it came to lay people trespassing on their territory. So the relationship between lay people and monks was in that sense quite complex, in that definitely, and this is what we see in early Buddhism as well, the monks had a lot more privilege in terms of their own legal autonomy, very much in line with Indian Buddhism, but also the sort of the earliest edicts we have when monastic Buddhism, let's say, was just established in Tibet, where monks are given more rights, I would say, than lay people. This continued for a very long time, and monks indeed were expected to deal with their own legal issues unless it affected, or unless it, there was in cases of murder, and which of course makes entire sense, and in some cases when treason was involved, and of course treason is a very complex matter, and it easily sort of becomes a sort of a trumped up political accusation. But at least this was what was, the idea behind the legal situation of these monasteries. And it's absolutely here the monastic guidelines back up what we know from traveler accounts and oral history and such like, that they really did take care of their own legal matters. They mediated, the monks mediated issues when lay people had issues among each other, and also they were in some cases allowed to fine and otherwise punish lay people who would sort of in some way or another impact the monastery negatively, or sort of would break the rules of the monastery. So to that extent, you could say that in some cases, the jaig, the monastic guidelines, don't just contain rules for monks, but but also rules for lay people and whoever deals with that particular monastery. And that sort of presents us with a small problem because, of course, these monastic guidelines tended to be documents that were directed towards monks in particular, and not to lay people. But, you know, one can assume that these kinds of rules were often obvious, like, you know, you shouldn't hunt on monastic grounds, or you shouldn't sell alcohol on monastic grounds, things like that. But, you know, one can assume that these were communicated orally to local people, lay people in the surroundings.
Can you think of any examples that really kind of jump out in your mind when you think back at these anecdotes?
Let me think. One of the perhaps, and maybe I'm just sort of giving a juicy example.
Juicy
and this is
good.
Actually,
juicy
I mean,
good.
I am juicy is good, but I also want to say that, you know, when I was doing my field work, one of the monks, and actually generally speaking, you know, I asked people questions, especially elderly monks, about how the situation was in you know, pre-1950s Tibet. And of course, I asked sort of critical questions, you know, how, you know, did people have enough food, and, you know, did people share, and how did they people deal with the lay, you know, the ordinary people, etc. And people were very, generally very positive to the kind of research that I was doing. Only one person who was actually from, I think, Spiti or somewhere like that, he said, oh, well, you are just doing this to, you know, to put the Buddhist monks in, you know, put them down or make them look bad. And this is really not the case. I would say for me, the many years that I've been engaging with this material, my respect and admiration for monastics has only increased, even though, you know, my book does also show the sort of the underbelly of you know, Tibetan monastic life. But of course, one of the back to the juicy example is that, you know, so some of these texts deal with what would happen if a monk would have sex. If a monk would break one of the parajikas. And of course, most of the texts would definitely say, okay, when you do this, you're out. You're no longer a monk. And, you know, these texts would then describe what happens when a monk is turned out, and the kind of punishment that he is given. But then there's also a case, and I also wrote a little article about that. And this is in a set of monastic guidelines written for all of the Sikkimese monasteries in the very early 20th century, where the author Sikyong Tuku, who was later for a very short while the Maharaja of Sikkim, you know, he tries to modernize to some extent the monasteries, but also he just wants higher quality monks at the monasteries. But he says, in so many words, you know, ideally you should be celibate, but if you do need to have sex, only sleep with your brother's wives. So, you know, that sounds, you know, of course, to a Western audience, that sounds outrageous. But of course, there is a reason for it. Because what happens when, you know, you as a monk step out and you have sex? Well, there is a danger or the possibility of procreating. And of course, once you have children, you know, you have a woman who gets pregnant, you have to take care of this, you know, the children economically. But if you have sex with your brother's wife, all the children that are born out of that union are your brother's and not yours. So they are taken care of. And of course, that whole notion of the sort of polyandry, where a woman has more than one husband, and often, and well, more often than not, they are brothers, is not strange to that culture. So in many ways, you know, it makes sense. So this author was very much aware that a lot of the inhabitants of monasteries in Sikkim were actually, you know, not keeping to their vows of celibacy. So he just sort of found a middle way in which to say, you know, if you really have to do it, then do it in a wise way, which is to have sex with your brother's wife.
Which now sounds much more rational in that context.
Yeah. Right? It's totally, it makes total sense.
Right. I think we've taken up a lot of your time already. So I just want to draw attention back to something you said in the conclusion about how the lack of religious competition, need to protect the Dharma in the age of degenerate age, that influenced Tibetan societies and has led to a comparatively low level of social change. And I think that's a really wonderful conclusion. And I don't know, I guess the question is, like, what next? What's next for this project and also for you?
So what's next for this topic? I think that, as I said in the beginning, a lot of or a fair number of scholars are taking up, are reading, have started reading this genre of monastic guidelines and appreciating them for what they are, namely very very valuable sources for the social history of religious institutions in Tibetan areas. This is something that I'm still very interested in. I continue doing research on exactly this topic. I think, I have quite a lot of research interests, but if I recently found out, like, what connects it, and I think that is where society and religion, so in this case, you know, Tibetan societies and Buddhist religion, where they touch, where they meet, or where they, you know, collide. It's exactly this is where I'm interested. What I'm interested in, and that takes me also to my current research project, which is on the interrelation, or, you know, the relationship between Buddhism and law in the Ganden Podong period, so mainly 17th, 18th, and 19th century. So I actually look at Tibetan legal texts, and, you know, these texts have unfortunately not been studied in great detail, and I look at what kind of Buddhist ideological ideas I can find in these. And it has been remarked by other scholars that actually these legal texts are very secular in nature, and, you know, they don't really resonate any sort of kind of Buddhism. But having studied these monastic guidelines, then I have actually found that it's not exactly the Buddhism as we know it. Also, the monastic guidelines, they don't talk about, you know, karma and enlightenment and all these things that we very, you know, sort of on a surface associate with Buddhism. But these legal texts do convey this a very interesting relationship with more Vinayic kind of Buddhism or monastic Buddhist ideology. So this is something I'm working on now. And in the same time, at the same time, I also see that these monastic guidelines and other sort of documents that deal with the management of monasteries are also influenced by these legal texts. So I'm looking at how these two kinds of texts and two kinds of ideas, Buddhism and law, how they worked together. So this, so I'm working on a book that will hopefully be that I hopefully will finish in not too long.
That's very exciting. Well, when you do, we'd love to have you back.
Oh yes, that would be wonderful if you would still have me after all of this.
Oh, definitely. We'd definitely have you back. Well, thank you so much for your time and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, me too. And I look forward to hearing more about your work.
Okay, great. Thanks.